Is it Ralph Lessie at trumpet, Ingrid Lobrock at saxophones, Jacob Sachs filling in for Chris Davis, who's the regular pianist in the project, Drew Grass at bass, and Tom Rainey at the drums. This is Jazz Amok right here on CKUT.
You need quality sounds? Tune into CKUT 90.3 on the Frequency Modulation Band Radio. www.ckut.ca on the internet. Streaming audio, archive shows, and information.
CKUT.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Good morning and welcome to this edition of Legalese, July 9th, and we will be focusing on the 20-year anniversary of the OCA crisis today. And I had racked my brain to try and come up with a good introduction to give some kind of context for those of you who don't know that much about the OCA crisis. Some of us might have been quite young when this took place in 1990. Some of us who live here now might not have lived in Montreal. That's the case for me. And I've spent the past month or so doing lots of research about this really significant event, but realized that someone else might be much better placed than myself to give a bit of a context about this event. So I have on the phone here Winnie Corn Miller, who is a Mohawk from Ganawage Mohawk Territory, which is located on the south shore of Montreal. And Wanique is the third of four daughters, and some of you may recognize her name for having been an Olympic medalist in water polo. And Wanique is also famous for having been behind the barricades during the OCA crisis. And good morning, Wanique. How are you?
Good morning.
And I was wondering if you could maybe give a very basic explanation of kind of the what instigated the events in 1990 from your perspective.
What instigated it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was the blockades had been put up on a little dirt road, not the main highway that everybody remembers, that main blockade, but there was a little dirt road that the little right in the pines that they had set up a barricade for about 3 months.
This was back in the early spring?
Yeah, early spring, in order to stop the expansion of a golf course that had actually been put in 1968, where they had basically cut down a beautiful pine forest, and they didn't want it to expand onto the traditional burial grounds of Mohawks there. So they were sitting there, and it was kind of very peaceful blockade. And then the town of OCA and the mayor of OCA was pissed off because he couldn't do his expansion to 18 holes of golf.
And this is Mayor Jean Ouellette. Sorry to interrupt, but we may be playing a clip of an interview with him later on in the show.
Yeah, that was who it is. And he decided to call in the provincial police, and they, early that morning, attacked the barricade with basically paramilitary force.
And this would have been early in the morning, July 11th, which is this Sunday marks the 20-year anniversary.
Yeah.
And how did you end up behind the barricade with your mother, and you had a younger sister there as well? You were 14 at the time?
Yeah, I was 14, and it was my mom was an old Native rights activist from the 60s, and she wanted to go and help and see what she could do, so we ended up following her. And then being 14, I couldn't stay home alone. My little sister was 4, so we went to be with her.
And, I mean, I'm sure you must have a lot of vivid memories from that time, but is there anything that sticks out in your mind, any particular events? The barricade was, the whole standoff took place over 78 days, I believe?
Yeah.
And were you there the whole time?
No, I was there, I wasn't there for the first maybe month and a bit, and I mean, it's 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's hazy. I'm sleep deprived now that I'm a new mother, but I was there for the last month and a half, I guess, in both Kanawagi and Ganastage. So it's what I remember is just, I guess the most vivid memory is that of just seeing those, like, I mean, I remember seeing race riots in mm-hmm. Chattagee, and I'm sitting on the blockade watching that. That was terrifying, watching Mohawks being burnt in effigy and mm-hmm. everything. And so I think, like, that and the stoning of the cars and the army, you know, being brought in, like, the whole environment was surreal. You know, having being brought up basically in Ottawa, and I mean, in Ganawagi as well, but being brought up in Ottawa and seeing all that, it didn't correlate with my view of sort of what world life should be like, you know. And but I saw a lot of amazing things as well, like, you know, proud my our community standing up for what they believe in, fighting for what they believe in. I think that's the most positive thing I saw. And then the peace kind of camps that were popping up across the country. That was awesome, too.
There were a lot of communities that came together, a lot of nations from across North America, and the Mohawk communities nearby all came to lend their support behind the barricades as well, right?
Yeah. We had people from all over. We had people, Canadian Student Federation sent out some of their Native students. We had Bradley LaRock and Bev Scow from Saskatchewan, and people from BC and Mi'kmaq from the East Coast and non-Native people, like just tons of people, like Oneidas. Like, it really woke up everybody. Like, I still meet people, like when I travel, and just telling me their experiences and how they felt and just how impactful it was to wake them up and to say, we need to fight for more than just subsistence living, more than just enough. We have a right to have more. We have a right to, you know, have the life we want and we deserve, because we're the Indigenous people of this country, you know, and we don't have to live in the dark shadows of Canada, you know. And I think the biggest impact of the Oka crisis, sort of nationally, internationally, is that it took off the veil, the fake veil that Canada was kind of showing the world, that mask of diplomacy and peace. And it showed them that, yeah, you guys are telling everybody else how to live, but how are you treating your Indigenous people?
Our hands aren't that clean.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of Canadians as well, from my experiences of in the last 20 years, is people saying to me, you know, like, I never learned about that stuff in school.
Mm-hmm.
And mad. We don't know about the true history. And I think that's the biggest service, is that keeping Canadian public in the dark, and it created an environment where the Canadians are like, oh, you Indians are just complaining, you get everything for free, and, you know, because they're not taught the true history of what truly happened to us, you know, and it keeps the two communities polarized, you know, keeps that attitude towards us, and then we get angry and it keeps us apart. And I think it's a huge disservice to not only our generation, but the generation to our children. Do we really want to pass down this conflict to our kids? Or are we going to do something about it? And I think OCA has woke up everybody to say, well, we should not do the disservice to our next generation of handing down that down. Let's make this country truly what it professes to be, you know, for everybody, and especially the Indigenous people. So I think that's what I've learned over the last 20 years, is that's what I want to be part of. And I don't want to be there to be more blockades and conflict, because having lived through it is incredibly traumatic to me and to the people who live through it, that we don't need to have that happen to our young people, because our young people are our most valuable resource. They're so valuable. They're so important that they get a chance to live a happy and prosperous life and not have to stand on a barricade like I had to and face down an army and get stabbed and all that kind of stuff that I had to go through and then live the years since having dealt with that whole traumatic experience and have post-traumatic stress disorder, which is what I had.
Now, you talked about getting stabbed. This is, I don't know if all our listeners would be familiar with this, but this was actually at the end of the siege when the warriors were leaving the barricades.
Yeah.
There was a lot of fighting going on with the army, and you were actually stabbed in the chest, I believe, with a bayonet.
Yeah, I was. I was, and I had my little sister in my arms. I was unarmed, and I have a big scar, actually right over my heart, my sternum. And I'm very lucky to be alive, the doctor said.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that motivated me, you know, too, as well, to do something with my life and to take that experience that right in the middle of my chest. You can't ignore it.
No.
And
someone told me that someone suggested to you that you get cosmetic surgery or something to hide the scar.
Yeah,
maybe
it's
when
a pretty
you were
ugly scar.
Competing.
Yeah, when I was younger. Mm-hmm. When I was younger, you know, I can't wear the lowest cut stuff, but you know, it's something that reminds me of how valuable my life is. You know, I when the doctor told me I was lucky, I was very lucky to be alive. I use that as a motivator. I started to say, "Oh my God, I am lucky. I have my whole life ahead of me. Time to go and achieve my hopes and my dreams and everything I wanted to do." That's what that reminds me of.
And you're currently living in Ganawage, recently had a child.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could comment a bit on the situation 20 years later in Ganawage, Ganasatage, if you think more in terms of the long-term impact of the OCA crisis, of the standoff. Can you see, as far as I've been able to inform myself, a lot of the land claims still aren't resolved 20 years later?
Yeah, that hasn't been resolved, and it's something that, you know, it just popped up again a month ago, you know? It's never been resolved, and the impact on these communities was hard. I think we're coming out of it now. Just the social impact, having gone through that very stressful experience and having seen a lot of violence towards us and then having to kind of show only one side of ourselves, like strength and power. But, you know, I think this community collectively suffered a lot of post-traumatic stress because, I mean, yeah, the crisis ended on the 26th, but it didn't end there. You know, we were under siege from police forces after, you know.
This is in Ganawage, you mean?
Yeah, in Ganawage, yeah, and in Ganasatage. It was a lot of trauma.
Harassment.
A lot of stuff, harassment and stuff that happened for years after. And so it's something that, you know, now we're a prosperous community and we're coming out of it, and I think it's important. It was a very important part of our history, but you know, we also have to look towards the future and, you know, and not having that happen again. I don't think anybody here wants that to happen again.
Now, I know you're a busy new mother, so I don't want to keep you too long, but going more to a positive message to leave our listeners with. You are currently the coordinator of the McGill First Peoples House.
Yeah, well, I'm on maternity leave.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm the coordinator, and I'm off for the next little while. So.
And what is your role as coordinator? I'm just
we run the Native Student Center, so it's like it's support for the students, outreach to the community to get more students, inside advocating in the university for more content and more classes and whatnot about to teach, you know, about Indigenous culture and everything. So we do a lot of different things. There's not one word that can encompass all that we do. Our current coordinator is Paige Isaac, and they're there, 3505 Peel, open all summer. And we usually have one of our big events is the powwow in the beginning of September.
And there's actually a powwow going on this weekend at Ganawage, which actually coincides with some events taking place in Ganasatage to commemorate the 20-year anniversary. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
You'd have to ask the people that are running it. I mean, the powwow was created on this weekend the year after the crisis to commemorate what happened. So it's been going on for almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
It should be an interesting weekend. I mean, I'm not doing any of the planning. I don't know exactly what's going on. But it should be fun. Everybody should come and check out the powwow, eat some Indian tacos, and enjoy the fun.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Winique, for speaking with us, and hopefully we'll be in touch again sometime in the future.
All right. Thank you very much.
All the best.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Winique Horn-Miller speaking about her experience in the behind the barricade during the Oka crisis in the summer of 1990. We have mentioned that it is the 20-year anniversary of the siege at the Ganasatage Barrier this Sunday. And there are many events taking place this weekend to commemorate these events. And I'll be telling you more about those later on in the show. And stay tuned. We also have some clips from a wonderful presentation from filmmaker. Now, please bear with me. I don't think I could ever pronounce her name properly, but I believe it's Alanis Obamsawin, something of the sort. And she kindly gave us permission to play some clips from a presentation she made a few weeks ago. But right now we have a band from Ganawage, some great hip hop. This is FBI. This is a track called No Reservations.
To deny your property claims. We didn't realize you were a sovereign community and nation out there. Where's your cocksucker's flag? Fucking Indian. Fucking Indian.
We don't need no reservations. We don't need no control. Don't suppress those and the
your mother dies, you bury her out back where your grandmother lies. You inherit a house and couldn't ask for more. One day a drifter stumbles to your door. You let him in for medicine, he rests in your bed. You wake up with a gun pressed to your head. He makes you sign a paper, you call the police. He shows them the paper, says it's all in the lease.
Look, I gave a beat, it's fair and square. That's the value of a house with the wear and tear.
He lets you keep the shed, builds a fence around. Does this with your neighbors, gets the rents in town. Sells all your stuff, keeps you quiet in the shed. Gives you barely enough to keep your family fed. Cuts the food source when you misbehave. Builds a golf course on your family's grave. You're living in prison and you can't make bail. You can hop the fence and still end up in jail. The house is your homeland, the lease is a treaty. The shed is the res, and we all know who's greedy.
We don't need no reservations.
Yeah.
This song is for the women and men that died because of genocide and those who identified the BIA. For the freedom that's been denied, how we were identified with numbers and set aside to see why they put us on a reserve. It wasn't meant to preserve a death camp and they act like it's something we deserve. The fact you can observe, so reserve the right not to serve the white if you got the nerve to fight. And don't be a sacrifice to the God they appease with SUVs and plasma TVs. Well, we can't afford to live free from disease, TB, diabetes, asthma, VDs, and crimes on the rise like the stats of AIDS. It ain't moccasin flats, but bats and blades are what kids carry. They don't give a fuck for grades, and it can get scary. Plus the drug trade's out of control. Young minds are broken. It ain't just smoking, it's lines of coking. My Indian people know I'm not joking, so you can soak in the words that are spoken from Okanagan to Hogan's in the South. We all got pimped by the white man's mouth, and keeping us down is what his government does. We gotta bring it back to the way it was, cause
we
Salut, ici Lucas de Ostara et vous écoutez CKUT 90.3 FM. Oui.
And we're back here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You're listening to Legalese, and we are focusing today on the 20-year anniversary of the OCA crisis. In case you missed it, we just had a very interesting interview with Wanique Horn Miller, who was behind the barricades with her mother and other family members. And she was only 14 years old when she got stabbed with a bayonet by a soldier from the Canadian Army, and survived and went on to win, I believe it's an Olympic gold medal in water polo for Canada. So pretty incredible. And right now we've got a few very short clips from some CKUT archives. One of our news directors, Gretchen, spoke with Eleanor Montour and Charlotte Montour Beaver. And here are a couple of very short clips about their impressions of the OCA crisis back in the summer of 1990.
They put us in a very bad spot because we knew that they had all the power to do what they want to our land, and that it was very sad for us that we couldn't right away fight back, except to fight the way we did and to defend our land and all that. But and when they said, well, we'll do this, and you bring down the roadblock and all that, we'll fix everything up. Well, it's very nice to say speeches like that, but we knew they weren't going to keep their promise. Nothing, whatever. And it was just to get us to believe everything as always. They have always told us things that went right, and we most of the time we believe. But oh, this time they're gonna be good. They're gonna do that for us. But never. And I guess they're mad because we don't want to give up anything as long as we're there as Indians, and we're going to defend what we have, and we'll never give that up. Whatever happens, we'll defend what's left of us.
It's hard, I guess, to take a step back and look at the big picture, but that's what's important here, to not isolate it as one event. There is a bigger picture to it, and that one is for the future, our future generations, to make things better and healthier and being in harmony, and going back to our traditional ways will help us do that. So, and to raise the level of awareness for our neighbors, just to be open-minded and get to know who we are as a people, and we'll all be stronger for the diversity that we have here.
And again, that was Eleanor Montour and Charlotte Montour Beaver. I believe that was interviews that were done at the 15-year anniversary of the Oka crisis. And coming up now, we have a clip of a press conference with Mayor Jean Ouellette. This is back again from 1990. And here goes.
Are you worried at all about the fear of, like, bloodshed, for example, if you send in the police, what your demand could ultimately lead to if the police go in?
I never said I was sending in the police. I just
asked for police intervention.
I said, we're giving you the case, have somebody to respect the law. The way they're going to do it, it's not my concern, it's not my job. I just told in that letter to the provincial police, we tried everything, and it doesn't seem to work. So what we do, we just say, take over, we just can't do anything else.
You think they should be able to force the barricades?
It's not my problem. I won't get involved in that at all. They know what they're doing, they're big enough, they know what they want to do. As I told them in that letter, that's it, we're just getting out.
Do you think it's worth all this trouble? Why not just drop your plans to expand the golf course?
What we're discussing today is the illegal occupation of that part.
But the natives are there because of the expansion plan.
Let's say that they're divisible. One is that they are separate issues. Do you seriously expect those people to believe that if they took down that barricade, you wouldn't go and start tracking the land right away?
This has been told, sir. This has been told in a public document the 14th of May. Okay, from this council, that the commune where the occupation is the municipal council voted the statu quo. Is that clear enough? The 14th of May, and that's a public document. These people said last week that they didn't know about it. Now they know because it was published by a newsletter all over the Indian community. Okay, and more. We offered 2 months ago a moratorium until the 4th of September just to sit down, just to start talking, and we told them that's only the beginning. Last year there was a moratorium for 9 months. So, please.
Can we ask the mayor to specifically say in public whether he renounces the idea of building an extension to the golf course over there? Do you renounce it in public? To build an extension for that.
It's not a project from the municipality. The golf course is expanding. We're not.
Golf clubs say the municipality is expanding. Golf clubs say the municipality wants it.
We just bought the land and it was rented to them. It's up to them to make the project.
Mr. Mayor, do you renounce your support?
I'm not giving anything.
Thank you.
We just listened to a track by Odaya, and this is Legalese on CKUT 90.3 FM. The show is focusing on the OCA crisis today. The 20-year anniversary of the crisis is this Sunday, or this is the anniversary of the siege. The blockade in Genesatage actually began in the spring and went on for a few months before the actual siege by the SQ, the Quebec Army, that took place on July 11th, 1990. And coming up next, we've got some clips from a great presentation by, again, please forgive my pronunciation, but Alanis Obamsawin, I believe, a filmmaker from the NFB. She is of Abenaki descent and has made four films about the OCA crisis, four films for the NFB. And I'll give you some more information about those films after we air the clips. It's a really great resource if you're looking to find out more information about the events that took place in 1990 and afterwards. I really encourage you to check out her films. And here are some clips from a presentation she made at Ganawage, part of the Présence Autochtone conference that was taking place there a few weeks ago. And the first clip talks about the relationship of politics to film and the subjectivity of documentaries. Ms. Obamsawin was asked about her point of view in her filmmaking, in her films, about the OCA crisis. So here we go.
What was your point of view in your series on Gansadar?
Man, if you don't know what my point of view is, you've got a lot of trouble, dear.
Articulate that.
Boy. I watched what was happening, and I saw people with a lot of courage and a lot of integrity, and I saw them being beaten by, when I say beaten, I don't mean physically, although sometimes it happened physically, but I mean in their minds and who they were. And I saw changes there. I could feel the changes that was happening to them in their own spirit. I saw that happen. And I, you know, it was very difficult. If I was to tell you here, I wasn't afraid, I'd be lying. I was afraid many times, especially at night, because of dark, almost like this. And, you know, you just didn't know who you were, where the least little noise, you ran there to find out what it was, and it was just horrifying to work in that kind of condition. But when I saw, I tried to show as much as possible what I saw there, what it felt like to be there, and watch people, how they move, how they make decisions, watch the different traditional people coming in, watching the changes with the warriors. What, you know, there's so many things that I watch. It made me think that's how they make war.
And next we have a short clip in which Alanis talks about her relationship with the NFB and her experience upon leaving the barricade, including her interrogation and interactions with the police and the army.
We're talking about racism that we experience while you're making a film. What conditions inside National Film Board did you feel? Were you getting resistance? I talked to Alec McLeod today, who did Accident Finance, and he got a tremendous amount of pressure or heat or obstacles thrown in his way by the National Film Board for his video. What experience did you get inside?
First of all, inside, when I was at the razor wire, many times I was told, you have to come out now. First of all, it was dangerous, and second, it was very expensive, you know, for us to be there. And I refused, and the director of my studio said, Alanis, this is the last week, you're coming out now. And I said, well, I'm not coming out. And then finally, when the chief told me they're coming out that weekend, I said, oh, I have to get out now, because I had so much material and I didn't want to lose it. I didn't want to be confiscated. So I said to this man who was the director, I said, I want a lawyer here and you here. I'm not getting into any police car or soldier's car. And they had the toughest time because the lawyer, who was the lawyer for the film board, was also under the same federal... Yes, like he was also the, for the soldiers. Like, you know, he couldn't... So I said, I don't want this lawyer here. I said, you have to find me another lawyer. So finally they searched, and they found a lawyer who used to be a lawyer for the army, was no longer, I think he had his own business now, and he knew all the ways in, and they said, he'll help us to get you out of there the way we want to. So the army said, Madame Obong-Sawin's going to have to come out of there, and we'll put her in an army. She'll have to be... they didn't say interrogated, but that's what it was, questioned by some people. And then she'll get into an army car, and we'll take her to Blainville, and the film board can come to Blainville to pick her up. And I refused. I said, I'm not getting to any police car or army car. I want the film board car to come here. I'll get in that car. No other car. And they wanted me out of there so badly, so they agreed. And so then the lawyer came, and... the director of my studio, and it was raining very softly. I came out, it looked like I'm moving out of something. I had so many things to carry. So the army didn't want to touch anything because they thought, they told me we didn't want to touch anything because they didn't want the warriors to be mad at us if we touched some of your things. I had to make a few trips, get my stuff across the road and go into this tent. And so now the film board, that's 2 days. I came out on the 24th, and they came out on the 26th. So then I went into this tent, and then I was interrogated, you know, for a long time. And it was, and they don't know anything about technique things that we do. So, and I had made a false statement. So this woman said, what's this? I'd say, oh, it is certain bobbin, it's a tape. What do you do with this sound? It's a voice of some people. And so go ahead. It was taking the longest time, and I remember I had 17 of them. So a soldier comes and says, what are you doing? It's taking forever. And she said, well, I have to identify everything she has. He said, give me that. He says to me, what is that called? I said, this is a... bobbin de son. Okay, how many? Okay, 17. Okay, what else? What do you call this? Well, the bobbin de video. But, okay, combien y en a? And I managed, when it was finished, he says, there's some officers who want to talk to Madame Obong-Sawin. And her, she touched me everywhere, and I said, I'm not taking my clothes off here, I'm warning you. Or go and see my brother, I'm holding, I don't know what, I'm coming back. So,
and in this next clip, Alanis is talking about the confiscation of media materials during the Oka crisis in 1990.
So finally, you know, I came out and I came to Montreal for one night, and then I went right back in, but I couldn't get into behind a razor wire anymore. I had to stay with the other journalists, and we filmed from out there. And we had to hide our material. I was very frightened that they would come there to confiscate because they went to CBC. They went to Channel 12 and confiscated a lot of material of certain days. And CBC went to court and they lost. And the judge said in Quebec, that's when a new law came, the judge said that in a, such a time, they call it a time of war, that the army and the police have all the rights to confiscate your material. Can you imagine? So they never got it back. So it means like if anything else like that would happen again, they would prepare themselves to make sure nobody gets in. That's why it's so important that each communities have cameras inside and they know how to use it and they can identify and document themselves and what's going on in the community. Because something like that happened again, it's not going to be easy for anybody to get in there. I mean, in terms of communication.
And here, Alanis is talking about the situation in Ganasatage today.
I think there's so much going on in Ganasatage that makes me feel very sad. I think it's very difficult to come to real decision because there's different leadership, and it's obviously it's hard for them to agree. And this is what I feel very bad about. For them to have the success for any community is that you have to be together. And if you're not together, then you start hitting each other, and that's the real cancer. That's a cancer that you cannot cure when it comes from your brother, when it comes from the criticism of yourself within your family. You cannot make yourself feel better. And I feel this is what I feel very sad about, because ever since then, nothing has been, the land issue is still not resolved. And there's been some things that, some few changes, but I think inside the heart of the people is troubled. And I would like to know that somehow it could be, that there could be a change there, and that people could speak with one voice. Until that happens, you lose. And this is for all of us. And I don't know what it's going to take. And I think within a community, it's very important for each other to look at each other. And it's going to take a long time, because people have different groups and different ideas about what life should be like or what the rights should be. So you need people who have a lot of wisdom to try and bring people together. I think it's possible. I think it's going to take a while. Maybe I won't see this. But I think it will come to that. It will have to come to that.
Yo, check this out. This is Flavor Flav, and you listening to C. Yo, check 1-2. This is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy. And you listening to K. Yo, check 1-2. This is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy. And you listening to CKUT, and the place to be, from the bottom to the COP.
And I just looked out the window. It is really coming down out there. I'd heard that there was a chance of thunder showers this afternoon, and I guess the rain has started. Anyway, we were just listening to some clips by NFB filmmaker Alanis Obomsawin, a presentation that she made at Ganawage a few weeks ago for the Présence Autochtone Festival that was talking about documentary and politics. And I mentioned I would give some more information about Alanis's films. She did four films about the Oka crisis, the first one being her most famous film. It was made in 1993. It's Genesitage, 270 Years of Resistance. And I've heard many people say that this is really kind of the critical piece or media piece, resource of information to refer to if you want to get a good synopsis of all the events that took place. And two other films that were more biographies, one in 1995. Again, I'm afraid I'm not going to pronounce this properly, but My Name is Kain Tiosta, and in 1997, Spud Ranch, Ganawage Man. And probably the most disturbing of the four is Rocks at Whiskey Trench, made in 2000. I watched this just the other night and was utterly shocked. For those of you that haven't seen the film or heard about these events, this was partway through the Oka crisis, when the residents of Ganawage had heard that the military was perhaps going to be invading the reserve, the women, elders, and children decided to flee for their safety and organized kind of a caravan of cars to cross the Mercy Bridge to get out of Ganawage and stay somewhere in Montreal, kind of in hiding to avoid the confrontation that was said to take place at the reserve. And by the time it came to crossing the Mercier Bridge, there was a huge mob of residents from Châteauguay and surrounding areas. I don't know, I wasn't there, but I've heard it was hundreds, if not a couple of thousand people that had accumulated by the time all the cars had reached the Whiskey Point. It's named Whiskey Point because of the whiskey distilleries around this. It's right near, I believe it's the exit, the Montreal side of the Mercier Bridge. and this big mob had accumulated waiting for the cars to pass, and as they passed, they threw huge rocks at the cars through the windshields, hitting women, children, and elders. And the police stood by and watched this happen, and many people were taken to hospital. And there's someone, actually an elderly gentleman, I believe in his 70s, who ended up dying of a heart attack, I think the next day, from related injuries. And there were babies, like less than a year old, who had to have shards of glass removed from their skin. And it's, anyway, I'm kind of left speechless by this. It's making me emotional just even talking about it, because I can't believe that this would take place here 20 years ago. It's not so long ago, and these are our neighbors who did this. And like I said, the police just stood by and watched and didn't stop anyone. There were no arrests. I believe actually there were a few arrests, but all the charges were dropped afterwards. So I think it's really important that people learn about these events, because as I said, I'm shocked that this took place. I wasn't even aware of this incident, and I think it's really important for us to learn about these events that took place right next door. So yeah, I highly recommend checking out these Alanis Obomsawin films. They're available on the NFB website, which is www.nfb.ca. I believe most of them are available to watch for free online. And again, the most famous one is Genasitage 270 Years of Resistance, which gives a very good overview of all the events that took place in 1990. And I've spoken to a few people about different resources to get more information about these events, and I've heard several people say they're disappointed that there isn't more current information, because I'd be very curious to know about what the situation is today, 20 years later. As I mentioned when I was speaking with Wenny Korn Miller at the beginning of the show, it's my understanding that a lot of these land claims still aren't resolved. As she said, The standoff began basically with the Mohawks trying to protect their land that they consider sacred. And I don't think she mentioned that as part of the Pines, there's also the burial ground, basically the Mohawk cemetery, which is right next to the golf course. And this is part of the land that the Mohawks were defending. And I would be very curious to know, I heard that the federal government in the year or two after the Oka events in 1990 actually purchased some of this land. But as far as I know, the Mohawks still don't have an official title to this land. So perhaps on a later episode of Legalese, we could look into that a little bit and try and speak with some of the lawyers to look into the specific land claim issues involved in this dispute. I just thought I would use today to give people a bit of an overview on these events, because as I said, I think it's something a lot of people don't actually know that much about. Most of us think of Oka and think of cheese, and maybe think of, I remember seeing some Mohawk warriors on TV with big bandanas over their face and big machine guns, and just being a little bit terrified by that when I was a kid. But finding out more about this and speaking with some of the Mohawks and finding out that they were really just defending themselves. They were portrayed as terrorists by the Canadian government, but in fact, they were just acting in solidarity. The Mohawks of Ganawage, which is the reserve on the south shore of Montreal, were acting in solidarity with the Mohawks of Genasitage, which is near Oka, about an hour outside of Montreal. And again, all I remember as a child was hearing about the blockage of the Mercier Bridge, because my father, who lives on the south shore, was complaining about not being able to get to work on time, and was like I said, some people on the south shore, particularly the residents of Chateauguay, were really not pleased with this. But as I think Alanis mentioned in the clips, I think once people learn more about these events and different perspectives, I think they definitely acquire a completely different understanding of these events once they see both sides. So we're going to listen to a small audio clip now that was recorded actually in the summer of 1990. I believe it's called Soundtrack of the Siege. So it was recorded live, I think, at Ganawage, possibly Ganasatage. It's the Top of the Hill gang. Have been listening to Legalese on CKUT 90.3 FM, and we have been focusing on the Oka crisis. We'll be right back.
Good afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM.